Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to another exciting and informative edition of Atlanta Business Radio. I'm Ryan McPherson. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a very special episode here today. We are going to be talking about caring for the aging and more particularly about Alzheimer's. But before we get to that, let's remind our listeners to connect with us on social media, Twitter, at Business Radio X. And today we're using the hashtag Atlanta Business Radio. Also, check us out on Facebook, like us and leave your comments there, and you can see photos of all of our in-studio guests. And now it's my distinct pleasure to welcome my co-host for the day, Jenny Hewer. How are you doing, Jenny?
I'm good. How are you doing, Ryan?
Fantastic. So this is a subject matter that is very, very deep, and we brought in an expert like yourself to help us dissect it all. But before we get into that, tell us about your business and what makes you such an expert in this subject.
Well, some information about me. I am a doctoral student at Mercer University studying counseling, education, and supervision. Crossing my fingers to graduate in July of 2017, so the countdown is on. I am working on a graduate certificate in gerontology from Georgia State University. I'm also a licensed associate professional counselor who specializes in working with older adults, baby boomers, caregivers, and individuals with Alzheimer's disease. And I work at the Georgia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association as a care consultant and work with the director of public policy and advocacy. So I am not an overachiever at all.
No, you're just very passionate about things in life. I can see that
Yes.
for sure. And so we're thankful to have you part of the program here today. Like I said, you are going to be able to help our listeners understand this in a way like never before. So why don't you introduce our guest who's joining us in the studio today?
I sure will. Her name is Nancy Kreisman, and she is author of the book, The Mindful Caregiver, and she also works at Geriatric Consulting Services. And she is our very first guest on the very first show of Yes. Caring for Aging Parents. And I thought, what a great topic to start out with for this new show, but then with caregiving. How are you doing, Nancy?
I'm doing great, and I'm so excited to be here today. Thank you so much.
Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a licensed clinical social worker, and I got my degree back in 1982. I've been in the field about 33 years. I absolutely have a tremendous passion for helping what we now call, instead of caregivers, care partners, help them sort out and deal with all the different kinds of challenges they have when somebody becomes frail and ill and particularly has some sort of dementia.
So share with me about the meaning of the title of your book, The Mindful Caregiver.
Well, the reason I came up with this title was about mid-career in my own career. My mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And I realized that she probably was going to live with it for a while. In fact, she lived with it for 17 years. And I knew that I had to find a way to stay engaged and connected with her. And I realized that as she was losing more of her cognitive abilities, I was going to have to find other ways to still have meaningful connection. And that's where I started to think about the spirit and the idea of being intentional about how I found ways to take care of her and be with her. And then I started looking at the whole mindfulness idea and thought to myself, wow, this is something that caregivers really need to be thinking about, because what mindfulness does is it helps people to connect to their heart, to slow down and to recognize, you know, how they're feeling, what they're trying to do in terms of taking care of others. So that's how this mindful caregiver kind of came about.
Tell me how this book is different than the other books that are out there on caregiving.
Well, before I actually wrote the book, I went ahead and really examined as much as I could of all the different books that are out there on caregiving. And one of the things that seemed to be a common theme was it was about helping caregivers feel less stressed. And if they took better care of themselves, then they'd be a better caregiver. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, that's not really the reason you want to have a caregiver book. You want to empower people, and you do want people to take better care of themselves so they can care, have more energy and ability. But more importantly, what I noticed in my private practice when I was working with caregivers was that they were losing themselves. they were putting off their own enjoyment and engagement and travel and everything else because they felt like, and their kids, their families, because they got so absorbed in this caregiving thing. And so the book, the reason it's different is that it really focuses on self-care. I always say to caregivers, self-care is not an option, it's a necessity.
Now, how is caring for an older adult different than a child?
Well, you know, this is something that really hit me hard when my own mom was middle of her disease and she was starting to lose more of her physical capacity. One of the things that really hit me extremely hard was when she lost her ability to toilet herself. And I remember people saying to me, well, there's no difference in, you know, having somebody in an adult diaper, so to speak, as a child. And I thought, no, that's not true at all. I mean, people are losing their abilities, and therefore, you know, it's very different than taking care of a child. And the other thing that really concerned me was that people were looking at people, especially with Alzheimer's and various kinds of dementias, as children.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was imperative for me was to keep that relationship with my mom as daughter and mother and give her the opportunities, even with some of the dementia down the road, to still be my mom.
I like that you said that because I was taking a class at Georgia State last semester called Psychology of Aging, and the professor corrected the thought of role reversal. It's not role reversal. That adult-parent relationship is still there, so it's really role changes.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. In fact, I talk about that in the Mindful Caregiver book because that's a really important piece. When you start to think of an older person who's losing ability as a child, then you treat them that way. Mm-hmm. And it's very demeaning.
So let's talk about the spirit side of caregiving, the mindfulness.
Well, you know, that was something that I started to observe even before all this when my Caring Spirit book came out back in 2005. I was going into some of these assisted living communities and nursing homes, and I was noticing that the energy, the feel, the spirit in the buildings felt dead. And then my mom, this was the funniest thing, when she was in the nursing home, we were sitting at the table one day and she turned to me and she said, you know, Nancy, I think the people around here are all dead.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because they were kind of, you know, you couldn't feel their spirit. And then I started noticing as well that when the caregivers who had more of a spiritual connection, they were, you know, they were coming from their heart, they were really showing caringness and all that. Mom was wonderful with them. The people that rushed her and just didn't seem to pay attention to their approach and kind of treated her more as a disease than a person, she would get more agitated around.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how this whole business of spirit sort of evolved for me.
When you mentioned that the individual with Alzheimer's disease is not really known, they almost become a third person in it. The dissertation I plan on working on is the lived experiences of individuals with early stage Alzheimer's disease, because I have found in the research, there's so much there about caregivers, but just the voice of individuals with Alzheimer's disease is lacking.
Yes. In fact, I do want to put a little plug in here. There's a new organization, it's about a couple of years old now, called the Dementia Action Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they're really focused on, and I'm a part of this organization, is how to help people with dementia live fully.
Mm-hmm.
And to change the words that we say about Alzheimer's. Because when we think of it as doom and gloom, and you know the people are sufferers and all that sort of stuff, then that's how we attribute the way we care for them and the way we think about them.
Some of the individuals that come into the Alzheimer's Association that I get the pleasure and honor of chatting with, they share that they are now fully in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
They are practicing mindfulness versus their caregivers. They're cherishing the life that they currently have in the moment. So I find that very unique.
Yes, and that is actually something I talk about again in the Mindful Caregiver, where I talk about one of the gifts, in a sense, of having dementia is that it does help you to stay focused in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned with my own mom that it was such a delight to not have to just to be with her and watch a butterfly or a hummingbird and not be worried about what's going to happen next and just enjoy our time together. It was much more focused time.
I had a student that I spoke with earlier this week, and she has a mom that has Alzheimer's disease. Her mother doesn't recognize her anymore. And I explained to her, but you know who she is. You can spend the time with her and hold her hand and be there present with her. I just want to let the listeners know that the meat of this book is amazing. There are so many resources and tips in there. One point that I've noticed is when we get calls at the Alzheimer's Association from caregivers who want their care recipient to do something, such as go to an assisted living or go to the doctor, but the individual is resistant. You mentioned the term therapeutic lying. Can you speak to that?
Yes, actually, I want to kind of share with you that as that term has been evolving in our profession, one of the things I now call it is compassionate deception. But let me explain what we mean by that. And you only would facilitate a therapeutic lying situation with a professional helping you do this. The idea of it is that when people get to a stage in their dementia in which they aren't really aware that they're having memory issues and that they can't take care of themselves and all that, and they refuse help or they refuse to move to an assisted living, you can't fight them. You know, you can't try to convince them that they need to go. And so you have to kind of come up with a sort of therapeutic lie or a compassionate deception in which you, the professional, like myself, would sit with the family and we would try to come up with a way to get somebody into a care community, having to sort of do a little bit of a lie. And so, for example, I can tell you about a gentleman that I worked with who was a big golfer. And what we did, and he wanted to move into a golf community. And so when I met with him, I talked to him about the idea, I found this really great place and it's a kind of a golf community and I think you would really like it and that sort of thing. And so he went in there with the notion that he might be playing golf and that there might be other golf buddies. And there were a couple of residents that had played golf, so we were able to set him up that way. So that's kind of what's called a therapeutic lie or compassionate deception.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking right now about my mom and dad. That's the line my mom might have to give to my dad.
And let me
we get to that point.
Let me add one more thing about that. Compassionate deception or therapeutic lying is much more difficult for spouses than it is for adult children, because a lot of this generation of people that we're currently taking care of are people that have been married for 40, 50, 60 years. And it's very difficult for them to lie. Mm-hmm. And so they can't, it's hard for them to get into this place of being able to say to their wife or husband, you can't live here anymore. You know, they want to explain it. And, or they can't say, like sometimes I'll say to them, when you go visit, you don't have to tell your family member you're leaving. You can say, I just need to go to the restroom. Mm-hmm. And then you just leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a therapeutic lie. Because if they tell them they're leaving, then the person with the dementia is going to feel awful. And we don't want people to feel awful.
We often get the question, should I tell a loved one that tell the loved one that they have Alzheimer's disease? Mm-hmm. And what's been pointed out to me, and Nancy, you can correct me if the viewpoint is a little bit off, but what I've been told is that once an individual gets to a certain point in their disease, there's not much point in reminding them that they do have the disease.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the consensus. Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing I do want to make sure that people understand, and again, it's referenced quite a bit in different chapters in my book, is the notion that when you know one person with dementia, you know one person. And everybody has to kind of go on their own path with this. And we have to be careful not to lump people into categories and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And so what I say to families around being truthful and not being truthful, when somebody, let's say that they think that their sister is still alive and the sister's died years ago, you know, you tell them that the person's died. And then next time if they start asking you, you might have to, you know, do a therapeutic lie in a way because you don't want to upset them because often they'll say things like, why didn't you tell me? Mm-hmm. And all that sort of stuff. So, but there are some people that want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not upset by you telling them, then it's okay. So that's why you have to be a little careful. You can't, there's not one pat answer.
And like you pointed out, it is the individual. And getting to know somebody with the disease, it's getting to know who they are well before the disease, the things that they enjoy doing, what type of jobs that they had, their personality. It's getting to know that person before the disease.
And actually, in the field now, what we're talking a lot about in this culture change movement is called person-centered care. And the whole notion of person-centered care is to know that person as they were, and then to try to filter in some of that with how they are now and what they can, you know, still understand and not understand and still do and not do.
Because when they are at a certain point in their disease, maybe perhaps not remembering how to do things, or is if you know how they were before the disease, you can implement activities that they knew and did as a way of living.
Right. Another example I can give you, what we did, and this is person-centered care. So I was working with a gentleman who was an MD, and he had a very, very successful practice, and he didn't forget his MD stuff. I mean, he still knew his medicine. And what we did when we moved him into the nursing home is we told him he was now the director there. And we gave him his stethoscope and his white coat, and he had a real chart.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat up at the nurse's desk, and he literally thought, and it was purposeful, meaningful activity for him.
I was volunteering at a community once, and they actually made one of the residents the restaurant manager. Our dining room manager, and she would organize, and I just thought that was wonderful. Also, we get phone calls regarding communication issues, and what information can we provide to caregivers who are having challenges, especially with care recipients who have Alzheimer's disease?
In terms of, well, here's the thing. It's important that you understand what they can, as best you can, what they can understand. And so there's a whole litany of things that you kind of want to do when you're trying to talk with somebody and communicate with them. And, you know, keeping it simple, you know, starting with, like you might, instead of saying to them, well, we're going to go out to dinner, but we have to get dressed first, and then we're going to do this. And, you know, you start out by saying, okay, let's go to the bedroom. And you get into the bedroom. Let's get dressed. And then you get dressed. And so you're doing one thing at a time. You're trying to break it down. Again, it depends where they are in mm-hmm. the process. And the thing that I worry about with early onset folks is that they can live a very full life. And the minute they're diagnosed, we put this stigma on them mm-hmm. and this label. And it's all, they can't do things anymore.
Right.
And that's not the case.
What realistic expectations are important for caregivers, and how do entrenched beliefs play into this?
Okay. So one of the things that I also noticed in interviewing older folks and their families for years and working with family caregivers and care partners is that one of the major things that seems to stress caregivers are what I have called entrenched caregiver beliefs, which are basically realistic expectations or unrealistic expectations that they hold on to for dear life. And it has to do with, I ought to, I should, I must, I have to. And when you hold on to those, and some of those have to do with the way you were brought up, you know, if the female was supposed to be the caregiver no matter what, even though there's five sons and one daughter, and the daughter's working full time and the sons are retired, it's the daughter because of these entrenched caregiver family beliefs. And so helping caregivers get in touch with what those entrenched beliefs are, and they're different for each caregiver, then you can sort of tease out what is really realistic, what's not. You know, look at your whole life and what's going on with you. As a family therapist, along with a social work degree, I'm very cognizant of recognizing caregivers have other parts of their life besides just caregiving.
Right. Yeah, the baby boomers have really set that precedence. And I have found in the research, now this is just a generality, but many baby boomers are somewhat what we call project managers. They want to maybe not have that hands-on caregiving, but they want to direct which services their care recipient is being provided.
Yeah, they're going to probably be in competition with geriatric care managers who are out there supposedly doing that kind of work. And my whole goal is to help, you know, when you talk about how is this book different, it's about helping caregivers have better relationships that are meaningful to them with their care recipients and to not feel, again, so defeated.
Yeah, you mentioned the feelings. One of those is guilt. Caregivers often feel guilty that they're not good enough, they're not providing proper care. What would you say to a caregiver who is expressing emotions of guilt?
And I can tell you, too, that guilt is one of the biggies. And the thing about guilt is that I usually validate guilt. Mm-hmm. And I say to caregivers, I am glad you feel guilty because that shows you have some compassion, that you have concern. The issue with guilt is when it starts to get in your way of making the proper decisions or trying to connect to somebody because you feel so overwhelmingly guilty. So I want caregivers in the mindfulness way is you don't judge your guilt. You say, you know, I feel guilty about this. You know, I kind of wish I could do more, or maybe I should do more. And then you step back and you start to look at, but what is really realistic here? So guilt is not a bad thing if you use it in a way that teaches you.
One of the other emotions that kind of then follows from guilt is that they feel guilty about feeling relieved, either when their loved one is placed or even if they've been caregiving for so many years. After the person has died, they feel relief and they're bothered by that.
Yeah, and again, I have a whole thing on that around looking at what's called anticipatory grieving. That when people have any kind of illness, whether it be cancer or Alzheimer's, the person is changing because of their disease. And your relationship is changing. And what's most important for mindful caregivers is to recognize they can't control at all how the person's changing, but they can, in a sense, control how they cope with it and think about what's going on for them. And I think, again, giving caregivers permission to be able to, you know, acknowledge all their feelings, no matter what they are, and to realize that relief is part of it, you know, that, you know, and so, I mean, sometimes it's called an overdue death, you know, when you feel like the person, you know, I can remember with my dad, you know, he had COPD and emphysema, and he started to have some dementia, too, and it just, you know, his illness just kept on getting worse and worse, and I, you know, there were times when I felt like, gosh, I wish he would die already and be more at peace. So helping caregivers recognize it's okay to say that.
It is a new normal. Mm-hmm. That's what I let caregivers know is you're in a new normal. Speak to a beginner's mind and self-care and self-full that you mentioned in the book.
Okay. Well, another thing about the mindful caregivers, I did a tremendous amount of research looking at sort of the Buddhist way. Actually, I looked at Native American Indian. I looked at Buddhism. I looked at Christianity. I looked at Judaism. I looked at a lot of the major religions and philosophies. What I love in some ways about the Buddhist way of thinking about things is that every experience, a beginner's mind is every experience is kind of a new way at looking at stuff. And when you have somebody with dementia in particular, every day is a new day. And every moment's a new moment. And so if caregivers, they often get stuck, you know, in wanting to do something a certain way or wanting their family member to be a certain way. And so a beginner's mind gives you permission to sort of surrender some of that.
You speak in the book about creating a circle of support. This can't be emphasized enough for caregivers.
And that factors into my whole self-full piece. And because when, and I made this word up, by the way, I don't think it's in the dictionary, but when you think about self-full, you don't want to be selfish, because most people don't want to be, and you don't want to be selfless, which a lot of caregivers are in a way. They give up their whole life. Being self-full means stepping back and getting in touch with your heart through using some mindfulness techniques, you know, breathing and just being quiet. And then looking at who in my life can be of help to me. And, you know, and how do I develop a circle of support around myself and around my care recipient?
Discuss being a partner in care.
Well, that's part of the circle of support in
right.
a sense. You know, one of the things I learned, my mother was in the nursing home for 14 years. I mean, she really lived there a long time. And I wanted to partner with the staff. I was no longer her primary caregiver. I was her secondary caregiver. And I needed to partner with the staff to help them understand my mom, to give them little tidbits, to show them pictures of when she was in a bathing suit, when, you know, when she was 20 years old, that she wasn't just this 80-year-old person with dementia. And so partnering with them, giving them the information, being an advocate, helping the folks, the staff there, to me, and caring about the staff. I mean, these are the folks that are in the trenches with our family members.
So you have another project that you're working on, and you shared that with us prior to the show, and it is very exciting what's coming up for you. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, my second heart, my first heart is empowering and supporting caregivers and certainly people with dementia. My second project right now that it's going to be sort of a book, I think, is on, I'm calling it something like creating connections. And it's the idea of helping families, once somebody is moved into an assisted living or nursing home, to visit, to have more meaningful visits with their family members. Because so often they'll say, doom and gloom, I dread it. And so this book is going to have all kinds of ideas, resources, and help families navigate through that time in their lives with their loved ones.
So you are working on this new project. What is the book writing process like for you?
Ay, ay, ay. You know, as I said in the second book, The Mindful Caregiver, I was telling somebody, this is a book on self-care for caregivers. You need a book on self-care for writers. You know, you have to be really good about setting aside time and being and having a willpower to stick with it. And actually, you know what I do? I go to the library and I write there. It's a beautiful setting. It's quiet. But you really do have to find ways to keep your own spirit up.
So for all you future authors out there, people that are working on their dissertations, my current cohort, we're all working on starting the process of writing those. You got to take that time, go to a place that you enjoy writing at.
Mm-hmm. And take care of, you know, fill your own spirit up, find laughter in your life, make sure you have something like I swim and that just is very meditative. Do meditation, hang out with people that you enjoy being with, fill your spirit.
So not only do you write about this, but you live this in your own life.
I try.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I'm not perfect.
Well, if there's one thing that you can leave the listeners with today about your book, what is one thought that you'd like to share?
Well, that self-care does matter, and that I want caregivers to be more mindful of paying attention to how they're feeling and how their body is feeling. I mean, that's...
Nancy, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. And I do have a website. You just can put nancykreisman.com, and you can follow me on Twitter. And what else?
LinkedIn, Facebook,
all that stuff.
Thank you so much. Well, we have exactly 2 minutes left. I want to tell you about a few events coming up next week. Alzheimer's Awareness Day at the Capitol is next Wednesday, February the 3rd. If you or someone you know has been impacted by Alzheimer's disease, come out to the Capitol and advocate to your legislators. But you have to register to attend. Go to alz.org/Georgia. And on Tuesday, February 2nd, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the state capitol, the Georgia Council on Aging will be organizing an event that will allow gerontology students from around the state to hear a guest speaker and have an opportunity to meet their legislators. If you'd like to attend the event, contact the Gerontology Institute at Georgia State University at 404-413-5210 or email gerontology@gsu.edu. If you'd like to be a sponsor on this show, email me at jenny@caringforagingparents.info. Our next show is Thursday, February 25th at 12:30 p.m. Our guest will be Chris Brannon with Brannon & Black, LLC, which specializes in elder law, estate planning, and special needs planning. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can find it on the show's website at caringforagingparents.info or Atlanta Business Radio. Again, I want to thank Ryan here, Stone Payton, and also Lee Cantor at Atlanta Business Radio for making the show possible. And I'll leave you with one of my favorite quotes. The best classroom in the world is at the feet of an elderly person. Until next time, this is Caring for Aging Parents.